Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massive demonstrations in Paris in support of national unity and first get an analysis from a French expert on the Middle East who served as a foreign affairs counselor in the embassies of France in Syria, Tunisia, and Jordan. Jean-Pierre Filieu, who is a professor of modern Middle Eastern history and contemporary studies at the Paris School of International Affairs, joins us to discuss the connections that the terrorists who killed the journalists and the hostages at the kosher market in Paris had to the so-called Islamic State, Daesh, and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and why, with such extensive records of jihadist activities, the terrorists were able to strike with such coordination and devastation. Then we will examine the connections to AQAP in Yemen that the terrorists who massacred the journalist at Charlie Hebdo had and how they were able to travel freely and often to Yemen to receive terrorist training, money, and guidance from the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a CIA drone strike in 2011. J.M. Berger, a fellow with the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World and author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam, joins us to discuss the Underground Railroad of jihadists coming from the European and American Muslim diaspora to train in Yemen and Syria to return home with deadly skills and wreak havoc. Then finally, we'll get a flavor of the huge demonstrations today in Paris as citizens across the ideological, racial, and religious spectrum join together to express their support for the slain journalists, policemen, and hostages killed in the kosher market and stand in support of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Philippe Green, the author of The Eco-Frugal Guide, which allows consumers to make choices that are both economical and ecological, who was recognized by the City of Paris in 2013 as an actor of the sustainable Paris, joins us to describe today's emotional tribute to solidarity and pluralism and discuss the possible political fallout from the past days of mayhem in the streets and suburbs of Paris. And joining us now from Paris is Jean-Pierre Filieu, who is a professor of Middle East Studies at Sciences Po at the Paris School of International Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jean-Pierre Filieu.
Thank you.
And apparently the terrorist who was killed, who had taken hostages and killed four people in the Jewish supermarket, has now proclaimed his allegiance to the Islamic State. And the other two brothers have apparently been connected to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. How much are these groups, do you think, claiming credit just to sort of out of convenience, or are there genuine connections, do you believe?
There is obviously a competition, a rivalry between all those groups to get, if I may say, being a French and being so intimately moved by what just happened, to get the prize of the Paris operation, as they already call it. So now you have two supposedly contradictory claims, one to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, by the Kouachi brothers, who killed the Charlie Hebdo team, and one to ISIS by the terrorist who killed four Jewish French citizens on Friday. My guess is that the ISIS trail is the hottest one, because I've been working already for years on the so-called 19th District Network, which is at the very core of this terrorist ring. And all those people are connected with Iraq because their role model, their role figure, named Boubacar el-Hakim, that already fought the Americans in Iraq in 2004 in Fallujah, is now a close associate to Baghdadi in northern Iraq and northern Syria in the so-called Caliphate. And he's one that the Kouachi brothers considered really as their reference, and is probably, but it's just an educated guess, the one pulling the strings from the Middle East on behalf of ISIS.
So this 19th arrondissement cell, How much have any of these terrorists, either the brothers or the terrorist killed in the Jewish supermarket, have they really gotten the sophisticated training, as some claim? When you look at their behavior, or intelligence terms, tradecraft, it seems very amateurish and reckless. They left behind their identifications in the getaway car, etc. What is the understanding?
Yeah, I agree with you. But having been on war zones, especially in northern Syria, you often have contradictory behaviors that are very professional when it comes to combat and killing, very amateurish when it comes to the daily life, because those people are coming from a cult and they have been protected by the cult from real life. And suddenly when there is a reality check, they do very stupid mistakes. So what is sure is that the Qureshi brothers got terrorist training of impressive level when they were in Yemen with Al-Qaeda. Koulibaly was the one who took and killed four hostages in a Jewish supermarket, was a delinquent, a criminal, whose experience was basically mugging and attacking banks. So you have the two different styles. But what is impressive when this network is that the people who have been trained in Syria and Iraq by ISIS have been trained by people with intelligence background from the Syrian and Iraqi regimes. That means from Assad and Saddam's regimes, which when it comes to, you know, mafia-like execution style, killing like Charlie Hebdo, they are unfortunately pretty efficient.
Well, that obviously, it doesn't require great skills in amongst defenseless civilians when you're heavily armed. But where did
yes
they get that?
Yes and no, because you have what they did when they came out, and you had this poor, wounded policeman, by the way, of Muslim and Arab origin, who was lying on the ground, and the way they just shot him without even stopping, very, you know, quietly, very cool, show that those people had quite an experience with guns, the same way they behaved when we came out and were killed by the French police at the end of their hostage taking.
So how did the Qureshi brothers get the kind of armaments that they had? Apparently they had a rocket-propelled grenade, they had a number of AK-47 assault rifles, they had grenades, and these were hidden in their apartment in Paris. And there was a report that some of their neighbors were aware of this cache of weapons, but were intimidated into silence.
Yes. Rocket-propelled grenade, I'm not sure about it. AK-47, certainly. This is the weapon that they used. But, you know, compared to America, France is pretty gun-free. So, obviously, like everywhere in the world, you have underworld pockets where you can get guns. I'm not specialist into that, but I don't think when you get the money, and apparently they had thousands of euros budget, part provided from Yemen, part provided from ISIS, you can get any weapon you want anywhere in the world.
Again, I'm speaking with Jean-Pierre Filieu, who is a professor of Middle East history and studies at the Sciences Po at the Paris School of International Affairs. And where is the money trail then? You just mentioned, and I believe that the Qureshi brothers, one of them mentioned that he had, in a phone interview he did with a journalist, that he had gotten that Al-Awlaki, the cleric in Yemen who was killed by a CIA drone, he apparently claimed that he was actually funded directly by him. Have the French...
Yes, that was his claim. And this claim is credible because he was trained in Yemen in 2011, so just before the CIA operation against Imam Awlaki. And it's probably when he got this training and the funding that I was referring to, but it's certain also that it got another part of the funding from ISIS, as Koulibaly told in the video that was disseminated today.
So my understanding is, and there have been some criticism of the French security authorities, that that these terrorists had such a rich, if you will, record of terrorist activities, terrorist training, histories of one, of course, spent time in jail. Their association with the radical clerics was all fairly well established. And my understanding is that the wives communicated, and there's possibility up to 500 phone calls were intercepted by the French intelligence authorities. How do you address the criticism that somehow the...
I'm from academia. My job is not intelligence. Personally, I didn't know the Qureshi brothers were in Yemen until the New York Times published it. So I don't know when and how this information was conveyed by the American intelligence to their French counterpart. So I'm sorry to say that I cannot comment. But anyway, whatever the issue of the intelligence, the key is in the Middle East, and the key is with Daesh or ISIS. And so far, the US-led campaign has not achieved any significant success because it has to be coupled with grand operation that only revolutionary forces in Aleppo and in northern Syria can achieve, with a clear mandate to be free from Bashar al-Assad bombing that is still going on heavily on anti-Bashar and anti-ISIS forces.
Well, of course, that is the
Sorry, I have to go.
You have to go on French television now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. They're calling me now.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much.
Okay.
Very much for joining us here.
Thank you. You're too kind. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Jean-Pierre Filieu, who is a professor of modern Middle Eastern history, and he teaches at Sciences Po at the Paris School of International Affairs. And unfortunately, he had to go on French television, so we were unable to finish our conversation, but we at least covered some of ground. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the Yemen connection to the Paris terrorists with the author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is J.M. Berger, who is a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World, and the author of the critically acclaimed Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam, the only definitive history of the U.S. jihadist movement, and co-author of the forthcoming ISIS, The State of Terror, with Jessica Stern. He also publishes the website intelwire.com and is a regular contributor to Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, J.M. Berger.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And the connections to Yemen and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the American-born preacher Anwar al-Awlaki seem to be pretty clear in this case. And I'm somewhat astounded at how these Qureshi brothers could travel back and forth to Yemen with the kind of records and visibility that they had. At least the French intelligence service seemed to be had a long dossier on them, and were able to attend. One of the brothers, of course, was able to attend this jihad training school in Yemen that previously John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, had attended. So has Yemen been, you know, a sort of part of the Underground Railroad here for jihadis going from the diaspora to get trained and come back and wreak havoc?
Definitely. I mean, Yemen was one of the premier destinations for Westerners who wanted to take part in jihadist activity prior to the war in Syria. And, you know, as part of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, their focus was on using Westerners to send them back to their home countries and carry out terrorist attacks. We don't have the full story yet on what's going on here, but what we do know, it sounds like they did not spend a lot of time there. They were there briefly, they met al-Awlaki, and then they left.
But Saeed Chuachi had traveled to Yemen and he'd attended the Imam University, which is headed by the fundamentalist preacher Majid al-Zindani. Now, I take it that the Houthi rebels have overrun that school and effectively shut it down.
Yeah, I saw the reports that he'd attended the school. What I saw this morning, the latest that I saw, was that he had spent 3 days at an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula training camp. So, you know, that's not just his time in Yemen, but that's the specific time when he was in contact with this group. Reporting on this so far is kind of thinly sourced. I haven't really been, you know, filled with confidence that some of the stuff is coming out. I think that there is something here, but exactly what I think is going to take a couple of days to play out.
So what do you know, though, J.M. Berger, in terms of how the U.S. works with the government of Yemen, as much as the government of Yemen seems to be in control of the country, in terms of watching people going to and fro, how lax are the visa requirements, travel arrangements, etc.? It appears to be fairly easy to go, come and go.
Well, certainly in the United States, people who are going to and from Yemen get extra scrutiny. But ultimately, there's a lot of travel in and out of this region that is not connected to jihadism. It's a lot of people. And, you know, even if you just narrow your field to the people who are connected to jihadist movements, there are a lot of people involved with this. And, you know, the problem that we saw here with the Charlie Hebdo attack is that these guys were known to French intelligence, known to Western intelligence, but they're just one of many, and you never know out of all these people which ones are going to act out, and we don't have the resources to watch every single one of them all the time.
Well, the ratio of watchers to suspected terrorists is pretty high, isn't it? You're talking about man hours, etc. This gets to be incredibly expensive, doesn't it?
Well, it can. I mean, it takes, you know, I've seen some of my friends in law enforcement have said it takes 20 people to surveil one person 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what we're seeing in a lot of these attacks is that they could happen sort of at any moment, that you just watching these guys isn't even necessarily a guarantee you're going to stop them. So, for instance, there were two attacks in Canada, you know, a couple of months ago, and in one case, one of those attacks was a driving attack. He just drove a car into a crowd. So, you know, even if you were following that person 24/7, you might not be able to stop them from acting out if they can just do something on the spur of the moment like that. So it's a real challenge for law enforcement and for intelligence.
And again, I'm speaking with J.M. Berger, who's a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution's project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world and the author of the critically acclaimed Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam, the only definitive history of the U.S. jihadist movement, and co-author of the forthcoming book, ISIS, The State of Terror, with Jessica Stern. He also publishes the website intelwire.com and is a regular contributor to Foreign Policy. So if you have this situation where these marginalized second and third generation youth in European countries who are having difficult times with employment and under social and economic stress, but at the same time they have access to the Internet and via the Internet they are able to download extremist propaganda, and then become extremists themselves. And then, of course, there's cheap air travel. And obviously all of this is motivated by a violent extremist ideology. And there, I suppose, how do you identify the roots of this? I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of people say, well, you know, when you peel off the layers, you end up in Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's a tough question. I mean, you know, the Saudi role is certainly part of this, but when you look at these cases, particularly with Westerners and, you know, particularly I found with Americans who get involved in these movements, what you see is that there's no one reason that people get involved. Everybody comes at it from a different context. Some people might just be inclined toward violence for personal reasons. Some people have a political grievance. Some people might be responding to economic conditions. But there's no one overwhelming characteristic that sort of distinguishes somebody from someone who will have an interest in this, who'll be a radical, you know, a nonviolent radical, to somebody who's going to take up violence and act out in one way or another. So, you know, when we look at this, it's tempting to try and seek out sort of a broad brush that you can use to draw a box around this and say, we're going to put these guys in it, and then we'll know where to look for potential risks. But it's really what we've seen over, you know, decades now and hundreds of case studies is that there's not a real consistent profile.
So, but what is the lure, though? I mean, there seems to be at least a consistent consistency here that all of these people are born in either in the U.S. or in this case France, and a lot of them are petty criminals. So, do they, like John Walker Lynn, do they have a kind of an epiphany at some point or other in a religious sense? I guess there isn't any prescribed formula here. But what have you discovered they all have in common?
We see different paths. I mean, you know, what they have in common is that they, for whatever reason, are buying into a narrative that's being presented to them by an extremist group. And, you know, traditionally what we've seen extremist groups do over the course of many years, and not just jihadists, is that they put forward a narrative about their identity group being victimized. So white supremacists, for instance, aren't acting out necessarily a megalomaniacal desire to control the world. They're acting on a narrative that says that they've been victimized, that they're losing their franchise. And so the same thing happens if jihadists in the Muslim world, and then there can be a political context that sort of sells its narrative to them. One thing that we've seen that is changing now with the rise of the Islamic State is that the line they're pitching to potential recruits is much more about strength. It's not so much about, you know, selling people that they are in a position of weakness. They're saying, we are strong, and you should come be strong with us. And that's having a very dramatic effect on recruitment.
And that, of course, has got the French authorities concerned because so many of these young jihadists who leave France to go to Syria return. I mean, I don't know what the percentage are that return disillusioned or return ready for mayhem.
Well, that's a good question. We've seen reports of people returning disillusioned. The problem is those stories are very difficult to come by because you can't really share your story without fear of prosecution. We don't have good mechanisms to deal with returnees, whether people who are disillusioned and maybe can be reached or reintegrated into the community in a good way, or people who are coming back with the intention to carry out harm. Another question that's really out there that we don't know the parameters of is how many of these people are coming back just because they're coming home for one reason or another, you know, regardless of how radicalized they are. And people who are coming back as operatives of a terrorist organization, whether it's ISIS or al-Nusra or al-Qaeda, where they're, you know, they are sent back on a mission with money and some direction, which is what the Charlie Hebdo attackers claim has happened with them. They said they were sent with money and with direction to carry out a mission. And it was some years before they actually acted, so we don't really know exactly what that entails.
But prior to the recent emergence of the so-called Islamic State or Daesh, this fundamentalist school in Yemen that I mentioned, the Imam University, in 2008, the French intelligence officials told the British newspaper The Observer that the school was the favorite destination for 200 to 300 young hardline Muslims from France who travel for religious instruction each year. along with people from England as well. So there's just one school that they've been watching since 2008. So if you do the math, that's, you know, thousands of recruits. And now you have this new phenomenon of people, as you've pointed out, being attracted to the Islamic State, not so much to get terrorist training to wreak havoc in the West, but to join in what they consider to be a powerful movement that's going to change the Middle East.
You know, the thing about the Al-Aman school is that there's some controversy or at least ambiguity about exactly what its role is. The gentleman who founded it, Abdelmajid al-Zindani, was up until the recent events that have really destabilized Yemen. He was a participant in the political process in Yemen. He was involved with the Al-Isla party, and he was considered a very conservative but mainstream figure. And there was some, you know, reticence, I think, on the part of the Yemeni government to go after him in a very aggressive way, possibly because they felt the evidence didn't support his role in that kind of thing, or possibly out of political considerations. But, you know, certainly his name has circulated, in this kind of discussion for a very long time, and the school does tend to show up in a very dramatic way in some of these plots, but not everybody who goes to the school is necessarily going to go on to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
But doesn't that get to the heart of the ambivalence here, or the ambiguity, or the very sort of narrow difference between conservative imams and radical imams?
Excuse me. I don't know that there's a real subtle difference. You can be conservative and radical and be against terrorism. And, you know, there are a few figures who really successfully skirt the line on that. But there are many more figures who kind of fall pretty firmly into one camp or another. I mean, Zindani is definitely somebody who a lot's been written about him. I've looked into him a little bit. Other people have looked into him much more. His involvement in this is, you know, suggestive. We look at him and, you know, people like me who are interested in understanding what's going on here are very interested in him, but I haven't seen a real definitive account of exactly what his role is.
Well, you have studied Anwar al-Awlaki extensively, J.M. Berger, and so let's talk about his journey from conservative preacher to a radical one.
Al-Awlaki began in the United States. He was born here. He grew up in Yemen and then came back here for college. And he initially was studying engineering, but he took an interest in religion and became an imam. And from a fairly early point in his career, there were certainly signs that something was amiss, that he was more than just a regular moderate preacher, although he presented himself as that very effectively. But he was the subject of an FBI investigation prior to 9/11, and then he had contact with the 9/11 hijackers when they were in the country. And after that, he found the United States an increasingly uncomfortable place to live, partly because of the FBI investigation of his connection to the 9/11 hijackers. And he eventually went to Europe and then back to Yemen. And slowly but surely became more and more overtly radical. And then one reason he was such a powerful figure is that he's a very effective speaker, a very powerful storyteller. And he established himself as a mainstream lecturer and mainstream preacher, and was really very popular. It was very distressing to a lot of Muslims who were moved by his speeches when he started to move in this much more radical direction. So, you know, there's a little bit of a narrative that sometimes pops up in which people say that he was radicalized by 9/11 and by how he was treated after 9/11. And I think the evidence is that he was radicalized before that, but he kept it, you know, he started off with it very much under the surface, and then it slowly began to surface in his work until he finally came out as being part of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in the late 2000s.
And where did he get his money from, given that he's one of the Sharif, I think it was Sharif, the two brothers that massacred the cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo, claimed that he financed his trip to Yemen, where, of course, he got training and was given the orders to do what he did.
Yeah, if that report is true, I mean, it's true that he said it, but if it turns out to be true that that's what happened, then, you know, that money probably came from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. At that point, Laki was, you know, heavily involved with them. And, you know, there's been some back and forth. There's a little bit of ambiguity about his role. But, you know, I think at this point, everybody kind of generally agrees that he was heavily involved in AQAP's external operations, which is what they call terrorism outside of Yemen. So, you know, there's pretty strong evidence to suggest that he had a pretty important role in that. And, you know, whether it was completely in charge of it, or whether it was just one of several people who were working on it, that part we don't know. But, you know, there is certainly in the case of Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who tried to bomb a plane on Christmas Day some years back on behalf of Al-Qaeda in Arabian Peninsula, it was clear that he interacted with Al-Laki as his contact point to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
And, of course, the one of the most wanted terrorists of all who's in Yemen is the bomb maker, right, who was, almost got that bomb. I think the Saudis broke up that operation, but it got pretty close, did it not?
Well, Ibrahim al-Assiri has had several attempts as the bomb maker. He's considered a great threat by U.S. intelligence. He's created some bombs that are very ingenious, but he has not so far had a real big success with them. So the bomb that Mutallab used was able to be snuck past security, but it wasn't able to be detonated successfully. Similarly, he had designed bombs that were placed on UPS cargo planes that Saudi intelligence broke up that cell and was able to divert those planes and defuse the bombs before they could go off. So, you know, and there are some other attacks that he's been involved in. So, you know, he's definitely seems to be very ingenious and have a good mind for the stuff. But what he builds tends to be very elaborate bombs. And, you know, the more elaborate your bomb or your scheme, the more opportunities there are for an enemy intelligence service to intercept it.
But one of the things I think that I find puzzling, and I'm sure a lot of our audience do as well, is that on the one hand, you have these people going off to be trained either in Yemen by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or by the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq and returning to wreak havoc. But whatever their training is in terms of military terms, their executions often seem sort of incredibly reckless and amateurish. And I suppose it doesn't take a lot in a modern advanced society where, because of infrastructure, et cetera, we're all incredibly vulnerable and we don't, after all, walk around armed to the teeth. So it's not that difficult to kill unarmed people, obviously. But there seems to be throughout this post 9/11 era of terrorism a kind of thread here of amateurism, whether it's the shoe bomber who couldn't light up his explosive shoes, the underwear bomber, the two Chechens on the streets of Boston running around creating mayhem, robbing gas stations, just as the two French brothers did. One of them left his ID behind in his car, etc. So so much of the hype is about how deadly this is all is, but on the other hand, when you look at it, you think, my God, you know, these are reckless amateurs.
Well, prior to 9/11, people involved with Al-Qaeda could go and really get training that would last months or years, and they would be involved with plots that would be planned for months or years. And after 9/11, with the increased pressure that the West has put on these organizations and that the local partners have put on them, it's much more difficult to do that. So, for instance, these guys reportedly had 3 days of training, which is really virtually nothing compared to the kind of training that a hardened Al-Qaeda terrorist would get in the past. You know, there are other considerations here. For one thing, you know, there's a cost-benefit analysis about how much are you going to train people when you can get pretty much the effect you want with somebody who's a talented amateur or who has a very basic kind of training. An attack like this particular, you know, really reflects the shift in how these groups are dealing with their external operations. You know, if you look at this attack, virtually any extremist group could pull off an attack like this. You know, it does not require any special resources. It does not require any special money. There are, you know, a dozen or more groups in the United States alone, not jihadists, who could easily pull off an attack like this and probably do it better. So, you know, the question is, you know, are you going to invest 5 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars in an attack like 9/11, or are you going to invest very little money and very few resources in something that can be accomplished very simply? And, you know, I think the calculus has changed because of both because of the pressure that we're putting on them in terms of counterterrorism operations, but also because a lot of these groups are now very locally focused. So Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is fighting an insurgency in Yemen, and ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra are fighting insurgencies in Syria and Iraq, and that is their main focus now. So right. Something like this where they can get a big return on a very small investment, it's very attractive to them.
Well, just in the last minute then, Jay Amberger, obviously the intention all along from bin Laden and all the subsequent jihadists has been to drive a wedge between Muslims and the West. And how much do we take the bait? I mean, clearly the Bush-Cheney administration took the bait. I don't think the French are taking the bait. But on the other hand, we are all guilty of taking the bait in as much as these becomes obsessive news stories. And these murderous losers suddenly are all over the media for days on end.
Well, there's definitely, a component to this that's very worrisome, and that is that these attacks are meant to polarize communities. They're meant to polarize people against Muslims. They're meant to polarize inside Muslim communities to get people for and against it. And while they still have a very small following, you know, numerically by any measure in any of these locations, the fact is that you can really change the conversation about what's happening in the country, you know, on a security basis, on a cultural basis with something like this. And I think France is very vulnerable to that right now. There's been a real rise in right-wing anti-immigration sentiment, and there have been numerous attacks on mosques and Muslims since the Charlie Hebdo attack. So, you know, it's an environment where we can, you know, our worst qualities can sometimes really escalate the situation and make things much worse.
Well, Jay Amberger, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jay Amberger, who's a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World and the author of the critically acclaimed Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam, the only definitive history of the U.S. jihadist movement, and co-author of the forthcoming book, ISIS, The State of Terror, with Jessica Stern. He also publishes the website intelwire.com and is a regular contributor to Foreign Policy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a Parisian about today's events. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now from Paris is Philippe Green, who has worked for 13 years in the financial sector. And in 2012, he launched EcoFrugalProject.org in order to promote projects that reduce our environmental footprint. He's the author of the EcoFrugal Guide, and he joins us from Paris, where today, Philippe, tell us about the National Unity Rally that you're just back from.
Yeah, actually, I was there just not so long ago. I'm just back home. It was a huge gathering in terms of people. There were more than 1 million people in the street of Paris. The atmosphere was very calm. People were coming from not only Paris, but also the outskirts of Paris. public transportation today were free, and one of the almost all the east of Paris was jammed. I mean, not jammed, but there was no car, and there were pedestrians everywhere. So there was a huge gathering to protest against and to defend the freedom of speech and protest against terrorism act down against French Jewish and French policemen, French policewomen, and to stand united together for our values.
And my understanding is that the normally feared CRS, the special police who were there doing crowd control, that the Parisians cheered the CRS.
Yeah, that was it's quite unusual. Usually, you know, the crowd is often against the riot police. And this is the, that's why this demonstration was really unusual. Well, that's another reason why this demonstration was really unusual. The spirit was really peaceful, and there was really a sense of belonging and a sense of unity, which means that we were able to overcome the, you know, the traditional bias, especially the one that sometimes people often have toward the riot police.
So tell me, Philippe, about the makeup of the crowd. Obviously, ordinary citizens of Paris and the surroundings. Given that there are 5 million Muslims living in France, was there displays of solidarity? Were there groups of Parisian Muslims in the crowds as well?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was like every age, religion, it was really a variety of, you know, it was a presentation of the French society. Everybody was there. Family were there with their children. The grandparents were in the streets. Everybody was there in the, and since, you know, the demonstration taken place on Sunday, it was many families were in the streets altogether also.
So what about the people that spoke? I mean, the politicians. My understanding is that Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front, which is the far-right wing anti-immigrant party, she was complaining on French television that she wasn't invited to the National Unity rally. Who was invited and who spoke?
You know, this event was mainly, even if there was some major politicians there and statesmen, you know, like, of course, French president, president of Israel and other countries. I think most of people went there just because they need to feel that they have a sense of belonging to the community, and they were not necessarily there to listen to political speech. And for instance, as far as I'm concerned, I haven't met any politicians on my way. It was, you know, mainly something about directly from citizen to citizens, you know. And I'm gonna watch to the news now. I'm sure that the French politicians have done some speeches. But frankly, I think most of the people who were there not so much interested in listening to what they have to say, but more they have something to share. They wanted to share this special moment together. I don't have much to say about, you know, the content of what politicians may have said. I have to watch the news.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Philippe Green, who has worked for 13 years in the financial sector. In 2012, he launched ecofrugalproject.org, which promotes solutions that are good for both the planet and the wallet in reducing our environmental footprint. He's the author of The Eco-Frugal Guide, which allows consumers to choose solutions that are both economical and ecological. And he has been attending the massive demonstrations today in Paris, the National Unity Rally. So in terms of what people are talking about in Paris, here in the United States, of course, there's a lot of discussion in our media about the enormous amount of knowledge that the French security authorities had about the two terrorist brothers and their accomplice who killed the hostages in the Jewish supermarket and was subsequently killed. And is now a video has emerged of him pledging his allegiance to the so-called Islamic State, Daesh. And obviously questions are being asked about how there was so much information on these people. They had been so clearly connected to jihadi movements. Why then was this such a surprise and able to happen? What are the discussions going on amongst Parisians?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very sensitive subject, obviously. More than 17 people were killed, and it's not something went wrong. That we have to recognize that. But at the same time, you know, France have been under threat for so many years, and you know, the overall death toll compared to other countries, for instance, compared to United States or Spain or UK, is not that that big. And I think it's it means that the French service, intelligence service, have been doing a good work. I think most of people in France acknowledge that. And actually, you know, the threat is so high, it's been so high for years, that what happened, actually, everybody knew that at some point, even with the, all the effort deployed, some terrorists would manage to go through. So we knew we were under threat. And so... You see, we in I think the French obviously don't want to point to the finger at the police, because they still recognize that they've been doing a great work over the past years. You know, what is puzzling is that, of course, these those terrorists have been known to the police for almost some of them have been known for more than 10 years. But you know, there's many people who now have been abroad in some Islamic countries to would have been trained by a terrorist, and went to jail and have been released. And I think the French intelligence service have been a hard time to keep everybody under surveillance, because it's this crowd is getting bigger and bigger, because now we have new French people coming back, or started coming back from Syria and other countries. And this crowd is getting bigger, and you know, we need to keep somebody under surveillance, under watch. Police was explaining, French police was explaining on TV that they need more than 25 policemen for one person to keep it under surveillance, you know. So it's a very complicated subject. But obviously, some things need to be improved, and there's still a space to improve things. And also for law procedure.
And in terms of the national trauma, if you will, over these last few days of mayhem in the streets of Paris and in the outer suburbs, are any people in France comparing this to, say, America's 9/11?
Yeah. It's of course, this is not not the same totally different scale. But in terms of symbol. In terms of I would say the shock, it's people are starting to say that it's our like a small 9/11, small because in terms of course the death toll is not totally different, but in terms of how it affects people mind, it's almost the same. And I think the reason why is people feel that way is that you know, Charlie Hebdo journalists, some of the cartoonists were quite old, and many French people have been raised up with those cartoonists. Everybody knew them. They were seen as true, nice, and peaceful people. And I think that's why every French can relate in a way to this, to what happened. That's for the Charlie Hebdo terror act, and of course what happened after with the Jewish French Jewish kill at the supermarket and the policeman. Everybody relate to what happened. But I think what we feel is that we were, French has been hit because also it stands for freedom of expression. Charlie Hebdo stands for freedom of expression. And it's all the French are very much attached to those, to the freedom of speech. And this is something we cannot accept, and we have to all stand united. And that's why we're, the unity march today got so many people in the street.
But what is the, what is the sort of DNA of these terrorists? Is it understood? I mean, they seem to make a journey from being criminals into terrorists, and I'm wondering how open and clear the indoctrination is. Apparently there was a cleric who had been operating in France who influenced the Kouachi brothers. There is an extensive video, apparently. One of the brothers was profiled on video, and there are lots of pictures of him with this radical imam. So how open has the because there was this fellow that just was jailed here in the United States who was ran the Finsbury Mosque in London, and he radicalized a lot of people, many of whom committed atrocities. He's finally been jailed in the United States, but it's always been pretty extraordinary how these radical preachers were able to speak freely, obviously taking advantage of freedom of speech in order to indoctrinate people into attacking the very country that hosts and allows such freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to define the to make a portrait of the common suspect, you know, but still, I mean, there's some often some they share, like, you know, we had Mohamed Merah like 3 years ago who killed like several Jewish kids in a Jewish school. It's often like they're often men. Age between 20 and 30 years old, they often have been in have major family issues. Either they were separated from the father or from the mother. So they often, I would say, like individual have been in a way lost, and they've been looking for some. Some truth and some this extreme ideology, religious ideology has been appealing. Has been appealing to some of them, to a small minority, just a few of them. But this attraction that extreme faith may have, I think, has many different explanations. It has to do also with the world, the geopolitics, also with the maybe the economical situation. There's so many factors coming together. So it's hard to explain.
Well, just in closing, Philippe Green, what do you think the political fallout is going to be in terms of electoral politics in France? The National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, in the last election got 25% of the vote, and a lot of analysts think that she'll be the beneficiary of this outrageous terrorist attack, that people will become even more anti-immigrant and xenophobic as a result of this attack, and that the National Front's ranks will grow. There is an alternative theory that this situation and the unity rally today in Paris, from which she was excluded, and of course, remember, Charlie Hebdo referred to the National Front as a clique of racist and fascist thugs. So she's certainly not welcome in terms of those that are mourning the loss of the cartoonists. So which way do you think it will end up in France? Will the National Front grow in popularity and political strength, or will they be shamed by this situation?
Frankly, I have no clue. I cannot make a guess. I don't expect any major change, in the sense that if there was already, National Front has already 25% of the cast, the ballot, they could increase maybe a bit, but I don't see any major change. I don't see, for sure, I don't think they're gonna lose some of the audience, but I don't think also they're gonna make a giant leap forward. So I don't expect in the near term situation any major change.
And in terms of the reaction here in the United States after 9/11, of course, billions of dollars were spent on the military and on the intelligence services, and they continue to do that today. A whole new government department called the Department of Homeland Security was created after 9/11, and many people in the United States argue that we have a kind of, we used to have what was called the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address. And now the people talk about the intelligence industrial complex. They talk about the terrorist industrial complex. In response to these atrocities, vast bureaucracies have been created and billions of dollars have been spent, and the results of which are not very clear. Is France likely to go through that as well?
I don't think so. For sure, in terms of, for instance, the budget of the national army, I don't see why they would increase it. What they may want to increase is the budget of the intelligence services, and that's already almost approved. They say they're going to hire like maybe 500 more people for the next year, because as I mentioned earlier on, more and more French people are coming back from Syria, and they need to be kept on the watch, under surveillance, and this requires a lot of personnel. So I think if there's some to answer your question, maybe they will need the state's gonna budget's gonna ask maybe several hundred million euros to hire more security personnel for the French intelligence service, but that's it. I don't see any other consequences about that.
Well, Philippe Green, I thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Green, who is in Paris. He's just returned from the National Unity rallies in Paris. He worked for 13 years in the financial sector, and in 2012 he launched ecofrugalproject.org in order to promote solutions good for both the planet and the wallet and to reduce our environmental footprint. He is the author of the Ecofrugal Guide, which allows consumers to make decisions that choosing solutions that are both economical and ecological. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.